This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Okay, we're joined by Professor Carl Murray from Queen Mary University of London. Welcome back to the Jodcast, Carl.
Nice to be back.
As Dave was saying before, you were last on the Jodcast at the end of 2007, and you're a member of the Cassini spacecraft imaging team, which is very exciting. The Cassini's been returning some great results for the past 5 years, I guess.
That's right, yes. We're 5 years into the mission around Saturn anyway, yes.
You've been exploring the moons and rings of Saturn, and in the news recently we've had some results which aren't specifically from Cassini, but they're from another spacecraft that's actually closer to the Earth, the Spitzer Space Telescope, and it's been doing some observations of Saturn and found something interesting. Can you just tell us a bit about that?
Yes, it's quite a fascinating result. What they've discovered is a ring around Saturn. Well, I mean, obviously we know Saturn's associated with rings anyway, but this one is much further out, and it's very diffuse, and it's associated with a moon, Phoebe. Now, the ring's enormous. Its radius is about 200 Saturn radii. The main rings, the Saturn radius, by the way, is about 60,000 kilometers. And the main rings that you could see through a small telescope, maybe a good pair of binoculars, they go out to about 138,000 kilometers, so that's just over two Saturn radii. So this is going out, you know, to sort of 200. So it's an enormous distance.
So if you were to look at a picture of this ring, Saturn would be a very small dot in the middle, I guess.
Exactly. I mean, it's being compared to sort of saying if you sort of knew where Saturn was in the sky, the size of this, sort of the angular size in the sky would effectively be a sort of moon diameter on either side.
Right, so more than half a degree or so.
Yeah, it's enormous sort of by any standards. And the first question that people usually ask is, well, you're involved in it, this mission around Saturn, why didn't you see it? And I'm trying to defend the project here. We actually flew past Phoebe on the way into Saturn. In fact, the original trajectory of the Cassini spacecraft on the way in was changed to allow it to have a Phoebe flyby, because we knew Phoebe was unusual in a number of respects. But one is, the most obvious one, is it goes round the wrong way. It's the first sort of large satellite that you come across as you're going out of the Saturnian system that has what's called a retrograde orbit. So essentially, if you were looking above the north pole of Saturn as all the moons are moving around Saturn, they'd all be moving around in a prograde sense, which is anti-clockwise. But this one is moving around clockwise. So there'd always been a suspicion that it was a captured object. And we've subsequently known in the meantime that there are a lot of objects, a lot of these are regular moons that exist around the giant planets at these large distances. And the fact that the orbit is retrograde is usually a clue that it's not really part of the Saturn system, or hasn't always been, that it's captured. So we knew that about Phoebe. And sure enough, when we passed by, we saw that it was obviously a regular shaped object. And the consensus now is that it's a Kuiper Belt object. We see lots of impact craters and so on.
So this is something from beyond the orbit of Neptune?
Exactly. Something that's been that's come in towards the Saturn system and been captured perhaps quite early on in the solar system. And as I say, one of many objects, in fact dozens of moons in the outer part of the Saturnian system that have been captured over the years. And there's a growing suspicion also that they've actually been colliding with each other. It's still a collisionally evolving system, which is not what you usually think about when you think of sort of moons of planets.
So if they collide, that would break them up as well?
Yes, because not only they'd be breaking each other up, but they're also, I mean, every object in the solar system is subjected to a bombardment of one sort or another, but it seems like they're colliding with each other in the outer part of the Saturnian system. So we kind of knew these things, but of course we have instruments on board the spacecraft that would be able to detect impacts and are functioning perfectly well. And as we go near certain parts of the Saturnian system, when we cross the ring plane, for example, the instruments detect these impacts.
So that's impacts with the spacecraft itself?
Yes. I mean, most of the times we're talking about micron-sized particles. For example, there's an E-ring, which is a diffuse ring, which is out at the orbit of Enceladus, and we even know about the source of that. It is Enceladus itself, material spewing out from the south polar region of Enceladus. And we can actually see that starting to produce this ring, and that's a diffuse one as well. And we detect that, and we can clearly see in the impact data on the spacecraft that these micron-sized particles are hitting it. And micron-sized particles aren't a problem for the spacecraft. We don't have to worry about anything until we get up to about centimeter size. But we've clearly detected all these kind of impacts and these micro impacts on the spacecraft. But nothing was detected that I know of at Phoebe that would indicate the presence of a ring. Mm. But when you read about this result, you realize that this ring is so diffuse. They're talking about a few particles per cubic kilometer.
Right.
You know, that's really diffuse. Okay, so the chances of hitting that as you kind of go through the system, and you only had one go as we came in. Ever since we went into orbit, we've never got out anywhere near the distance of Phoebe, so it was just a one-off flyby as we came in. First of all, it's interesting in its own respect because the speculation, when you see a very clear association with the orbit of the moon, as you've got in this case, the speculation is that the moon is actually the source of the material.
Mm.
And so that's what we think is going on. The estimates of the size of it, if you gathered up all the material, it would sort of fill about a 1 kilometer sized crater on Phoebe, and there are plenty of craters like that. So it isn't necessarily just one impact, it may be many impacts over the age of the solar system, but it is producing this material that we couldn't possibly have seen and would be almost undetectable with our instruments from within the Saturn system. But what is, I think, even more intriguing about this result, it's the last piece in a jigsaw that does relate to Cassini observations. In fact, goes back to the very first Cassini, which was Jean-Dominique Cassini, who was the director of the Paris Observatory in the late 17th, early 18th century, discovered several of Saturn's moons, including this very unusual moon called Iapetus, which was a major target for Cassini. And it was unusual because when he found it on one side of the planet when it was actually moving away from Earth. And when it should have come around the other side of the planet, he couldn't find it. And he had to wait 20 or 30 years before he got a better telescope that he could actually pick it up as it was coming towards him. Like all astronomers, they always want a better telescope. So when he realized that he could, but only very faintly, pick it out as it was coming towards him, he developed the theory that the only explanation was really that it was literally a moon of two halves. One half was very bright, and that was the half that would be trailing, so you could see it on as it was moving away from you. But the other half, the leading hemisphere, was very dark. So when it was coming back from behind the planet moving towards you, it would be very difficult to see.
Mm.
Now, that actually implies something that we know is the case with the Iapetus, because it's the same with our own moon, which is that it keeps the same face towards the planet.
So it's tidally locked.
Exactly. And it's a natural consequence of tidal evolution over the age of the solar system. And some moons get into that situation faster than others. So it's the fact that it's not that it's not spinning, but the moon spins roughly about once every 28 days, which is the same time it takes to orbit the planet. So from our point of view, we just see the same hemisphere. So that also implies that there's a leading hemisphere and a trailing hemisphere.
Mm.
And that's essentially what is happening at Iapetus and lots of other Saturnian moons.
And I think with Cassini's images from the spacecraft, you've been able to actually see the huge distinction between one side and the other side, haven't you?
Well, that's right. I mean, these were very carefully planned observations because we really had one close flyby of Iapetus. And the idea was to get in a situation where the difference between the dark hemisphere and the bright hemisphere was actually illuminated. So we had to be able to see that. And this was all done. We got these incredible images because up until that point, you have to consider the situation. Is this essentially a dark moon with bright stuff on one side or a bright moon with dark stuff on one side?
Mm.
And where did this stuff, whatever it is, come from? Is it from outside? Or is it something internal in the moon itself that was producing it? And a theory was proposed by a guy called Steve Soter back in the 1974. And it's a sort of classic in sort of planetary science in that it was the abstract of a conference contribution. So he presented it at a conference. I think astronomers would recognize this. But never actually followed it up with a paper. So it's not a published paper. It's one of the most famous in planetary science circles, one of the most famous unpublished papers, but everybody knew about its existence. And it's the idea that, well, perhaps the coating, and if it is a coating on the apophis came because it's dark and kind of reddish, like Phoebe is. If Phoebe was impacted by something and the material came off Phoebe, it would spiral in under non-gravitational forces, like a thing called Poynting-Robertson drag, and there are other processes. And the first thing it would hit would be Iapetus. So Iapetus acts, it's been described in various releases as sort of, like flies on the windscreen of a car as you're moving along. So it's just sweeping up as it goes.
Right, so it's getting splattered by the cosmic flies from
Phoebe. Exactly. And I think to a few of us, it always was the best theory and always was suggested that the material was external. I mean, the whole tying in with the fact that it was the leading hemisphere that was almost covered with this stuff all just seemed to work. So this, if you like, was the final sort of smoking gun, that you're seeing Phoebe and this ring of material. So there's no question now that there is material associated with Phoebe, almost certainly associated with impacts on Phoebe. And we know just dynamically that material will evolve inwards. And it may be that it's not just coating Iapetus, it will coat other moons as well as it goes through the system. The next one in after Iapetus is Hyperion. But that's unusual because it's actually rotating chaotically and it's tumbling and spinning up and spinning down. So if you like, it gets spread all over with any stuff. So the signature may be there, but it's kind of different than sort of leading trailing hemisphere. So it's a beautiful result, obviously not a Cassini result, that this new ring, but it ties in beautifully with the sort of observational data we've got with Cassini and solves, if you like, this sort of 300-year-old mystery.
Right. So is this ring quite young then? Would we have any idea what the age of the ring would be?
That would be very difficult to work out. But yes, there's a sort of a lifetime associated with it, with the particles, because this effect of Poynting-Robertson light drag is most efficient when it's acting on small particles, and they just start spiraling in. So when you get measurements, hopefully these will come of what the actual size distribution of the particles is, you can kind of work out how long the ring could have been around there. So it may be possible to work that out. But it still takes time, even for the material just to spread around the orbit from an initial collision, and there are all sorts of other forces operating.
Right. So it'll slowly move inwards towards Saturn then?
Yes. There's sort of an initial effect, which is caused by radiation pressure, which causes the orbits, which are kind of eccentric to begin with, to become very eccentric. And so you may get, in reality, the ring may kind of almost instantly go produce particles that go and impact the main rings even.
Right.
But the longer term effect is the Poynting-Robertson drag, and that's what causes the spiraling in.
Right. Just picking up another thing you said there about the smaller particles feeling more of the drag, does that mean that you get a difference across the ring on the size of particles, so you have smaller particles on the inner side of the ring?
Exactly. That's exactly the situation. In fact, there's a beautiful analog of this in a completely different context elsewhere in the solar system, which is in the asteroid belt. We've known for some time that there are families of asteroids, that there are sort of orbital groupings of asteroids that were always assumed to be originally several larger objects that then split up because the asteroid belt is collisionally evolving. But the IRAS, that's the Infrared Astronomical Satellite, that was sort of active in the early 1980s, discovered that there are dust bands associated with these asteroid families. And the three main families, called the Themis, Eos, and Coronis, all had these bands associated with them. And so that's actually, all those kind of observations have been refined since. In fact, it's an interesting story. A lot of the people who studied these originally weren't planetary scientists. They were actually galactic astronomers or even cosmologists who were studying the infrared background and wanted to get rid of the foreground in order so that they could calibrate the background. And so we kind of realized at that stage that there was an awful lot of interesting dynamics going on here, and while they just kind of wanted to do it to get rid of the signal or the noise, as they saw it, that was essentially our signal. And it's now realized, and a colleague, Stan Dermot, who discovered with others looking at the IRAS data, that this dust from these dust bands actually extends all the way into the Earth. And the Earth is like embedded in its own dust ring. And the source of this is not the Earth itself, but dust that's come from the asteroid belt and underpointing Robertson drag sort of is gradually spiraling in, and that you could see these asymmetries in the IRAS data, which were consistent with our understanding of the dynamics of this dust as it approached the Earth. So it's been a fascinating time, and the dust distribution kind of gives you a real insight into how things evolve in the solar system.
It's all fascinating stuff, and it's amazing that there's still lots of stuff out there in the solar system that you might think that we'd already know about, given that we've sent spacecraft out past it, but we still are finding out about things in our backyard, as it were.
Well, that's it. I think we have to understand our own backyard in the first place. It's the most accessible part of the universe, so let's start there.
So what other interesting results have you, in the past 2 years of Cassini, have you been working on particularly?
Well, I think when I last spoke to you, I was talking a lot about the F ring, and I'm afraid I'm still kind of obsessed with this ring. And we published a paper in the summer of 2008 where we finally kind of understood all this bizarre structure in the ring.
So the F ring was, just to remind people, was the one that had sort of spirals in it and almost interlaced rings.
Yeah,
together.
I mean, it's a bizarre system. When we saw it first the first really good images were with the Voyager spacecraft, and which were flybys in 1981. We saw this sort of twisted, braided appearance of the ring, that there seemed to be several strands. What we discovered early on with Cassini was that these extra strands are actually spirals, or have a spiral structure. And the explanation for that was that there had been some impact on the rings, or maybe continuous impact, and that material that had started out as a sort of a radial jet from this impact had then, because of Kepler's third law, because things that are closer to the planet move faster than things that are further away, the material that started off radial just gets wrapped into a spiral. So when you're looking at a close-up, you see multiple strands, but it's actually just one strand that is just kind of wrapped around the ring. So we knew that from quite early on. But we were trying to get down to the nitty-gritty of all the really detailed structure in the ring itself that you could see in the images. And we had taken a whole series of images at the time I was talking to you and since, where we were constructing a mosaic. So we're trying to get a snapshot. A snapshot, it takes about 16 hours to take the snapshot because we're taking so many images. But the idea was to reconstruct like a 360-degree high-resolution mosaic of what the ring would look like. And we could see, when we did this, we could see clearly these jets. And even we were able to show in this paper that one object that we've been tracking since 2004, which is called S2004S6, goes on and off, collides with the core of the F-ring. And we can actually see it in the images, and we can see that it is the sort of prime suspect for producing these some of these jets, at least. And then these jets go off and they shear and they form new strands, and so the whole process continues. But there are other objects as well, some that we can't even see, that are colliding with the core and producing these jets. In fact, it's the only kind of ring in the solar system where we can see almost on a daily basis the evidence for collisions, because the collision velocities aren't sort of the interplanetary sort of kilometers per second. They're more like sort of 30 meters a second. But it's sufficient at the F ring, we think, to break up some objects that may be in the core of the F ring, and that then they form these jets and then they move around. So we can see those. We've also seen these things we call fans, because they have a fan-like structure. And we know that these are now caused by embedded moons that are in the middle of the F-ring on slightly eccentric orbits with respect to the F-ring. And as they kind of move up and down with respect to the core, they perturb all the dust that's around there. And these features kind of come and go on timescales of just a few hours, but in a fairly regular fashion. So they're really good clues as to where there are embedded objects in the F-ring. And there was also evidence for even smaller materials, sort of down to the sort of kilometer level. All the kind of structures that we see in the F-ring, could be explained by objects that are either perturbing the ring or kind of locally colliding with the ring or even in the ring. So there's a whole range of populations of objects there. And it's still a puzzle in the sense that we're really trying to understand this detailed structure and kind of where it all comes from. And we have a situation where we've got this moon Prometheus, which is on the inside of the ring, which produces these beautiful, which we call streamer channel phenomena. So it kind of grabs material. We can just, it's beautiful because you see in gravity in action. It goes close to the ring, drags material out. Then that ring doesn't actually hit Prometheus, but kind of goes back into the ring, produces channels in the ring, and then everything kind of shears because of Kepler's third law. And Prometheus goes on and does the same again to another bit of the ring a few degrees further on, and then that shears, and we get these beautiful structures. So over and above everything else that's going on in the F-ring, we have about every 60 or so days at a particular location, Prometheus is going to come past and do its little bit to the ring. So it's an absolutely fascinating system, because we used to think of Saturn's rings as beautiful, regular, almost unchanging structure.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's emerged with the F-ring is that it's changing all the time, literally on timescales from hours, which is sort of the orbital period, sort of about 16 hours, right through to weeks, months, and in fact decades, because of the way the orientation of Prometheus and the F-ring change over time. So it's an absolutely fascinating system that is unique, as far as I know, in the solar system.
The last few years, looking at the website, which gives you the pictures nearly every day from Cassini, and it's just every day you're surprised by new and amazing pictures.
Yeah, well, imagine it from my point of view. I have to try and explain those new and amazing pictures.
Yep.
And I've done an awful lot of head scratching over the years. But now that the sort of, at least for the F-ring, sort of the picture that's emerging is, we're pretty sure that we understand what's going on. Every so often there'll be some new image that shows something that I haven't seen before. But the general picture is emerging, a very dynamic, evolving system. And then questions arise as to why this is happening there. And that's probably because of its location. It's because it's connected with the Roche limit, the idea of this location where the gravitational attraction between two nearby objects is just about balanced by the tidal force that's disrupting them. And so accretion maybe can take place, but at the same time, tidal disruption is taking place. And so we think there's a balance going on there, and several people have kind of studied that to figure out what's going on. So maybe that it's in a special location.
So Cassini itself, I think, is in its extended part of its mission at the moment.
Yeah, we're in what's called the Equinox mission, which is the first extension to the 4 years. Then the summer of 2008, we finished the nominal mission, and we were funded to do they call the Equinox mission, and then the next phase, if it gets approved by NASA and if funding is available, would be the Solstice mission, which would see it go from 2010 right through to 2017. But we've got our fingers crossed that we've got a really perfect working spacecraft at Saturn, and with all these things going on, I mean, I haven't talked about Titan and the changes that are going on there, and the atmosphere and the sort of jets from Enceladus. But there's so much more science to do, and in the mission where you're not doing a flyby, but you're actually in orbit around it. And as you can guess from the names, as for Equinox and Solstice, you're actually looking at over extremely long timescales.
So these are the Equinox and Solstice for Saturn itself, not for the Earth.
That's right. So last August we had the Equinox, which is the Sun crossing Saturn's ring plane. So for the whole mission up to that point, it was the underside of the rings that had been illuminated by the Sun. And then in August, the Sun just slowly moved from below the ring plane to above. And we'd been planning for this for quite some time. There were lovely Hubble images of the last ring plane crossing, which was, I think, around about 1994, 95. And we could see the shadows of the moons right across the rings, but we'd never really seen this up close. And so we realized shadows were the key, because you've got a situation where known moons, let's say, are casting shadows across the rings because the Sun essentially is such a low elevation, or like you get on Earth, obviously, it's sort of close to sunrise or sunset. So they could tell you things about the vertical structure in the rings themselves, like where is the shadow cast and where isn't it, and how does the actual path of the shadow kind of change as you look at it. So that was interesting. But even more interesting was the possibility of detecting vertical structure in the ring itself because of the shadow that it casts. And that turned out to be the case. So, for example, we found this object that we think might be about 400 meters across, sitting near the outer part of the B ring. No idea that it was there. There was no indication from any of the images this object was there. And we could only detect it in these images because of the shadow that it was casting, which was much larger than itself. So we also found, for example, there's a little gap about 30 kilometers wide near the edge of the A ring called the Keeler Gap. And we could see, we knew there was a moon in the gap. We'd found it had been suspected in Voyager, but we found the moon called Daphnis with the Cassini images. And as this, we also knew this moon was in a slightly inclined orbit with respect to the rings. But what we hadn't realized that we saw the images was this moon was therefore affecting the particles on either side. Well, we knew it would do that, but it's giving them a slightly inclined orbit as well. And we could actually see the vertical structure because the structure was casting a shadow.
So it's pulling them up and or down out of the rings.
That's right. So as it was going up and down, it was this is the beauty. Even though the particles were perturbed below the rings, the shadow could still be seen because the shadow was being cast. Let's say the sun was just below the ring plane. The shadow has been cast below the ring plane, but actually the effects of the shadow could be seen above the ring plane.
Right.
So we could get all these kind of beautiful observations.
The particles of dust on the edges of the ring near Daphnis, how far into the ring in distance does the perturbation go in pulling things up out of the ring?
Well, it varies from sort of moon to moon, but in this situation it's sort of tens, maybe hundreds of kilometers. It's a beautiful effect. They produce wakes, and similar in a way to the wakes that you get on a boat as it crosses a very calm lake. They move with the object. The bizarre thing is when you first see it, it looks bizarre. Is that it's sort of asymmetric. As you look on one side of the ring, let's say the inside of the gap, the material is ahead of the moon. On the outside, it's behind the moon.
So that's sort of the opposite way around than you'd think for a wake of a boat.
Well, it's all on the same side. You obviously would be bizarre if you saw the wake ahead of the boat,
yeah,
wouldn't you? So it'd be something unusual. But this is just Kepler's laws. What you understand is that the material that's on the inside of the gap is moving faster than Daphnis. So it's caught it up, being perturbed by it, and is now moving ahead of it. So the perturbed region is ahead. Likewise, the material on the outside has encountered Daphnis as Daphnis has approached, and there's already downstream that you see the perturbation. So that's why you get this asymmetry. When you first see it, you think, hang on, there's something strange going on here.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful against Kepler's laws in action. And so on either side of the ring, so it's not just, you get obviously the largest perturbation from the closest material, but you still get perturbations all the way in. And you can see this actually more clearly at the Encke gap, which is about a 300 kilometer gap further in. It's got a moon pan that's right in the middle of the gap. And you can see beautifully the edge waves that it creates. And then the wavelength just depends on the separation, the radial separation from the satellite orbit. But the amplitude of the wave depends on how close it is.
So that's how much it goes out of the plane.
Well, that's out of the plane or in the plane. You better get both. But if you just consider in the plane, you get this wake phenomenon. If you kind of draw the little streamlines of the particles, the paths that you would get, you see this beautiful wake phenomenon. And essentially, this is just a three-dimensional version of that we're seeing with Daphnis at the Keeler Gap. So it's a beautiful structure, which I suppose we kind of thought would be there, but it's so nice to see, because you're so used to thinking that the rings are just in a plane. The typical thicknesses of the rings, remember, are almost certainly less than 100 meters. And given that they're going out, the main ring's going out to 138,000 kilometers, they're extremely thin. So anything that's even a few hundred meters or a few kilometers out of the ring plane is enormous on this sort of scale.
These are all fascinating images. We'll try and put links to, or put some of these images on our web pages or provide links to them as well, because people really should go and see them. They are fascinating.
Definitely.
Things to look at.
Beautiful as well.
Thank you very much for taking time to talk to us. I could listen to this all day because it is fascinating stuff. And best of luck with your work on Cassini into the solstice phase of the mission.
Great. Thanks very much. Thanks, Stuart.